Our message this morning comes from Proverbs chapter 1, verses 10 through 19. These are the words of God. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait to shed blood. Let us lurk secretly for the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol, and whole like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all kinds of precious possessions. We shall fill our houses with spoil. Cast in your lot among us. Let us all have one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Keep your foot from their path, for their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood. Surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird, but they lie in wait for their own blood. They lurk secretly for their own lives. So are the ways of everyone who is greedy for gain. It takes away the life of its owners. Our God and Father, thank you for the heritage of your word. Bring it home to us in power and strength and in encouragement by the power of your spirit. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, teens, this whole series, as you know, is directed to you. This is a conversation between me and you directly. We're just allowing the adults to listen in. And so I want to speak these words to you. And this is just the way the book of Proverbs is. The whole book of Proverbs is a conversation between Solomon and you. He's speaking directly to you, young men and young ladies. Now, thus far in this series, we, like the book of Proverbs, have been emphasizing the foundation of all life, which is your relationship with God. It is the beginning. It is the beginning of the skill of living. You really don't know anything about life, and you really don't know what you're doing. You really don't know anything about happiness or fulfillment or how to find them until you start with God and the relationship with Him. But now, as Proverbs does, we want to start talking about some particular temptations, some particular dead ends. Things that easily lead young people off the path and lead them filled with bitterness in their mouths, everything turning to ashes. Now, for something to be a temptation, it has to offer you something you want. If it doesn't offer you something you want, it's not a temptation. And the strongest temptations of all are those that offer something you want at the deepest level. That is, something that offers you true fulfillment and happiness. And here we begin to see differences between boys and girls, because ideas of true fulfillment and happiness are different between boys and girls. This is why some temptations appeal more to guys and some more to girls. Now, one of the basic differences between guys and girls is one of orientation toward desire itself. And here is the difference. Boys want to desire. Girls want to be desires. Boys desire to desire. Boys want. They want this, they want that, they want everything. Girls have more of a desire to be desires. Boys want. Girls want to be wanted. And this is the way God has made us. It is not wrong in and of itself. It's only wrong when it gets skewed and twisted and perverted. So Proverbs speaks to boys and girls by speaking directly to the boys about what they should desire and what they shouldn't desire. It never tells the boys that they should not desire anything, that it's wrong to desire. It tells them that their desires have to be directed toward the right thing. So Proverbs speaks to the boys about what they should desire, what they should love, what they should quest after, including the kind of girl that they should desire and should not desire. And in this way, Proverbs speaks to what kind of man the boy should be. For biblically, one is defined by one's loves. One is defined by one's passions. In other words, one is defined by one's desires and the loves that one pursues. In the same way, Proverbs speaks to what kind of a woman a girl should be, and part of that is knowing what kind of woman God blesses with the only kind of man worth having, the only kind of man worth having pursue you, which is the only kind of man who can make you happy under the blessing of God. Solomon understood that given the way that God has made guys and girls differently, that if you gave girls a choice, that they could go into two different lectures. One of them is to go in a room with all girls listening to a woman tell them what kind of women they ought to be. Or they can surreptitiously go in the other room, which is filled with boys, where they are being told what it means to be a man and what kind of girl they ought to desire. Most women would elect to go into the second room and not the first. And that is why Proverbs speaks the way that it does. Now, the fact that we have desires, the fact that we desire fulfillment and happiness, this is not bad. This is the way God made us. Everybody, even the most religious person, even the biggest ascetic who denies themselves everything, they sleep in a horsehair jacket, they lay on a bed of stone, or they lay on a bed of nails, they stay out in the cold, they don't eat well. Even that person is doing what they're doing because they believe somehow, some way, someday, this is going to bring them greater fulfillment and happiness. That is the way God has made us. So the problem is not that we desire fulfillment and happiness. The problem is when our desires get misdirected, when they get misplaced, so that we pursue things in such a way that God is not honored, God is not in the picture, and as a result, we're never going to be fulfilled. We're never going to be happy. Proverbs tells us that God himself is to be our chief desire. He is to be our chief love. He created us for himself. He created us in his image. He created us as his sons and as his daughters. And therefore, he wants our fundamental response to be to him. Of course. And of course, that is the root of all evil, is that our first parents, Adam and Eve, turned away from God in that fundamental relationship. We often say that sex is created for monogamy. It's created for the monogamy of marriage. Well, sexual monogamy is the second kind of monogamy we were created for. The first is spiritual monogamy with the one true God. So God, his fellowship, his favor, his blessing, and all of life flowing from that, that is to be our chief desire. And if we don't have that right, everything begins to unravel. Now, we're going to be following the path of Proverbs and looking at the various prime temptations for boys. And of course, Proverbs is by reflection speaking also to the girls. The first 9 chapters of Proverbs is Solomon's introduction to the book. And in this really a poetically structured introduction, he hits all the main themes, and he covers all the major temptations to young men. After hitting the fundamentals of fearing God, being rightly related to him, and heeding one's parents, Solomon starts addressing the specific temptations, and the first one he hits is the one that is in our text. Now, when we read this text, on the surface, it seems to be talking about gang life. It talks about boys banding together to steal, to be predators, to prey on others, to gain loot and treasure and have all those things together. So it seems to be talking about gang life on the surface, or if you want to look at a sophisticated version of that, look at the mafia. Okay, they're wearing suits and ties, and it's business, and it's very sophisticated. Now, this might not seem on the surface really to apply to us very much at all, because to my knowledge, there are none of our young men who are tempted or on the edge of joining a gang or joining the mafia. But you have to remember that as Solomon goes through each one of these temptations and each one of these sins, he presents it in two different ways. One way he presents it is he presents the sinful plant fully grown, gone to seed, in full flower. This is what it looks like. But he also talks about the sin in the root form, in the seed form. And we see that here. Gang life, mafia life, that sort of thing, is this particular temptation in full flower, full seed. It's fully grown. But Solomon also here talks about the root And the root that he identifies is in verse 19. So are the ways of everyone who is greedy for gain. It takes away the life of its owners. So greed for gain is the root. Gang life, mafia life, organized crime, that sort of thing, is that same problem gone fully to seed. But you have to remember that this whole plant is wrong. It's wrong from the seed up. It's wrong from the root up. All along the way, any version of this plant is wrong. And that's Solomon's point, and we will come back to that. But let's first start out by talking about why in the world would this full plant, why in the world would gang life or the mafia ever be a temptation to young men? And the answer is, it contains a form of masculinity. Now, it is a twisted form of masculinity, but it is masculinity nonetheless. What are some of the elements of masculinity that we find in gang life or mafia life, organized crime, that sort of thing? Number one, mission. A gang has a mission. The mafia has a mission, just like the military has a mission. And guys are drawn to mission. Guys love a quest. They love a challenge where they have to work together with others in a unit. Now, girls, the way God has made them, are more naturally oriented toward relationship. And just look at the difference in popular men and women's fiction books. People write fiction books to sell them. And you can tell what men and women like by what they buy. If you look at a popular women's fiction book, the center of it is going to be relationship. There will be a plot, there may be a mission, but that's a context for the central feature of the book, which is the relationships. With guys' fiction, it's the opposite. The central feature, the feature of the book is the mission. It's the quest. It's the obstacles that must be overcome. Now, within that, you may have, some of them don't have any relationship at all, except for the guys in the unit. But there may be a romantic relationship in there. But the central feature is the mission. The second aspect of masculinity that we find in gang life or mafia life is danger. High stakes and high rewards. God has created guys to where they are attracted in a certain way to danger and to high stakes. Now, recent tests that have been done on the brains of boys and girls indicate that boys actually get a rush. They actually get kind of like a drug rush from danger, as long as it doesn't go too far. And so when you tell a boy, oh, don't do that, it might be dangerous, well, that's the point. That's the whole point. It's dangerous. And so it's a fun. He gets a rush from this that girls don't get. And so girls look at this like, that's stupidity. That's just stupidity. Okay. And the guy's saying, I'm getting high. Do you mind? There was a test that was done with guys and girls. And in this test, they have an empty room. And in the middle of the floor of the room, they have this peg that sticks up, 3 or 4 feet high. And then they give the contestant, either a guy or girl, they give them like 10 rings that they're supposed to throw over this peg. And then they have marked off in the floor 1 foot, 2 feet, 3 feet, all the way back to like 20 feet. And so every contestant always asks the same question, where am I supposed to stand? And they say, anywhere you want. And we're going to leave you alone. We're not even going to look. You're going to have privacy. Stand wherever you want. You're just supposed to throw the pegs over. You're supposed to throw the rings over the peg. Now, what they find almost invariably is the girls go, oh, okay. They stand right in front of the peg, and they just throw the rings down over the peg. It's like that. The guys don't do that. They back up from the peg, and they start tossing the rings to turn it into something that involves a risk. Then they do the same test, and with the girls, right before they're going to do the rings over the pegs, they have three other girls, same age, but unknown to the contestant, come into the room and watch the girls. The girls stand in the same place, right in front of the peg, and throw the rings down over that. With the boys, they're already backing up so far and tossing the rings. You bring three more boys into the room, the guys back up even further all the way back and toss it all the way back from the other side of the room. So the guys like the risk. They're drawn to risk and reward. And if you put other guys in the equation, the risk factor and the danger factor, they feed off of one another, and it starts going up more and more and more, which is why you need adult men involved when you have a lot of teenage guys doing things together, because at some point there does need to be a little bit of sanity, because things will get out of hand very quickly. And so when you have guys come together like this, everything goes up. It feeds and it goes up exponentially. It's either going to ramp up for good or it's going to ramp up for harm. It's either going to be good or it's going to be destructive, but it's going to ramp up. The great church father, Augustine, was one who lived a wicked life before he became a Christian, did a lot of wicked things. He talks about this in his book called Confessions. But out of all the sins that he had committed, which were bad ones, he said the sin that bothered him the most of all of them is when he was a teenage boy, he got together with a bunch of other teenage boys, and they went and they stole some pears out of a farmer's orchard. And you wonder, it's like, out of all the things you did, that's the one that bothers you the most? He said, yeah, because I don't like pears. You see what happens? They get together. He's going, what is it in me? I don't like pears. Why am I getting a rush out of stealing pears from this innocent farmer's orchard? And so you see the nature of sin in the individual. The boys wanted to take risk, and then you put them together. And if you don't have the Spirit of God leading them, it's going to get destructive quickly. The third element of masculinity present in gang life or mafia life is a military-like structure. Guys are drawn to military-type authority and military structure. You've heard me mention a number of times the corn maze test that they used on, I think it was about 12 or 13-year-old boys and girls. What they do is take a corn maze, and you take like 10 13-year-old girls, and you put them in the middle of the corn maze, and you tell them to find their way out. Then you do the same thing with 10 13-year-old boys. What happens is the girls, they always do the same thing. They stick together. They support one another. They walk around as a group, exploring the maze, comforting, supporting, thinking together. This is what they do. The boys always do the same thing, but it's opposite from the girls. A leader always emerges, and they fall out into a military rank structure, and then they divide up. You go here, you go over there, you report back, and they sort the maze out that way. Guys left to themselves are going to fall out in a military structure. There may be a struggle within that about who's going to be the top dog, but the fact that there's going to be a top dog and then a military structure, that is never in question. Back when I was in the military in the 80s, the very last assignment I had on active duty was as the legal advisor to the Southeastern Recruiting Command. It's something I never really thought about, that there's this entire sales force out there in the military selling the military. And so all these recruiters have their quotas. They're selling the Army, they're selling the Air Force, the Navy, the Marines, and they have to make their quotas. And a lot of times it's hard to make their quotas, and they're tempted to cut corners and so forth. And it's interesting, the one service that never failed to meet its quota was the one with the worst facilities, the worst locations, and the worst duties, and that's the Marine Corps. So why is it the Marines never fail to make their quota when all the rest of the recruiters who ostensibly have more to offer often struggle? Well, it's because it's the few. It's the proud. It's the Marines. And if you go in the Army, why do all the guys want to be a Ranger? They want to be airborne. They want to be Green Beret. If they're in the Navy, they want to be a SEAL. Why? Because it's the toughest, it's the hardest, it's the most dangerous. Now, women are very different with regard to authority, and this is the way God has made women. And I talked about this in the recent marriage series. God has made women so that they are repulsed by military-type authority. which is why that kind of authority has no place in a marriage. Women are repelled by that. They're repulsed by that because God has made them that way. So this kind of military-like authority, that's male-on-male authority. Men respond to that. Men gravitate toward that, and they want it in the proper context. Women, on the other hand, God has not made to respond to that kind of authority. And then the last feature I want to point out that is masculine is this idea of spoils. Spoils or treasure. You can see it in verse 13. It says, we're going to fill our house with precious possessions. And then also in there's another verse in here, I can't remember which one, that refers to spoils. Okay, spoils and treasure are things that are taken. They're not things that are worked for. And so spoils in this kind of context is a way in which a young man, or maybe an older man, basically flexes their muscles. When they're young teenagers, they want to show you their muscles. They want to show them off, okay? Well, as they start getting older, they start realizing there's other forms of muscle. Possessions, spoils, fancy car, all of these kind of things. That's just another form of muscles. That's an extension of your bicep. And you want people to see your biceps. You want people to see how strong you are. It says in Proverbs 20:29 that the glory of young men is their strength. And they want you to know how strong they are. And girls, they want you to know how strong they are. So they want to show you their biceps and they want to show you their stuff. And that's why they take an old a Honda Civic on its last leg and put a megaphone on the exhaust pipe and then drop it down so it doesn't have any more suspension, and maybe they'll put some neon lights up underneath it, and they drive down the road, and it makes a lot of noise, and they're saying, look at me, look at my biceps, look at my strength, look how strong I am. The fact that it's still a burned-out Honda Civic doesn't really occur to them. They want you to pay attention to how strong they are. All of these factors appeal to young men. And as I said, this is a twisted form of masculinity. But here's the key. To young men in a fallen world, twisted masculinity is better than no masculinity. And a lot of what our culture today and its gender-neutral obsession, which, by the way, is not neutral, it's really skewed now toward the feminine, what our culture is telling them is that there is no place for masculinity. All masculinity, all desire for military structure or danger, our aggression, our competition, all these things are evil, and there's no place for them. Well, twisted masculinity is more attractive than no masculinity at all, and these young men will find it where they can. And it's the same thing with young ladies. A guy with twisted masculinity is more attractive to young ladies as a whole than a guy with no masculinity at all. And this is why you see so many female Hollywood stars who spout feminist rhetoric fall for rappers, basically guys that are one step removed from a gang, motorcycle gang guys and all of that kind of stuff, many of whom write songs that are just filled with misogynist rhetorics. Take J-Lo and so many of these other stars and singers and so forth. They spout the feminist rhetoric. Look at the guy they're living with. He's just a picture of twisted masculinity. Because twisted masculinity is more attractive to a girl than no masculinity at all. A lot of these guys, if you listen to the lyrics of songs and rap songs and so forth that they do, It is the most demeaning stuff to women that you can imagine. And here is their feminist spouting girlfriend just hanging on their arm. So these girls, in spite of themselves, are drawn to masculinity. And like I said, twisted masculinity is better than no masculinity at all. So gang life or mafia life, that's the full flower. That's the full plant, fully grown. Let's look at the root of the plant. The root, verse 19 tells us, is greed for gain. Greed for gain. Now, gain of itself is not wrong, because the Bible tells us that God often gives wealth as a form of blessing. In Proverbs chapter 3, it says, happy is the man who finds wisdom. Length of days is in her right hand, in her left hand, riches and honor. In Proverbs chapter 15, verse 6, it says, in the house of the righteous there is much treasure. Okay? So gain in and of itself is not wrong. It is often a sign of the blessing of God. The problem here is greed. Greed. Now, if you want to understand the biblical concept of greed, I want to acquaint you with a Jamaican term that I learned back in the late 80s. They have a great term for greed, grabalicious. Okay, that's what the Jamaicans call greed, grabalicious. And it perfectly pictures what greed is all about. There's two aspects to greed. Number one, things, treasures, spoils are being sought for their own sake. They're being sought as signs of strength, of self-made power and conquest. And secondly is the idea of grabbing. These things are being grabbed. In other words, the mentality of young men in this mindset is, I have to have it now. I have to have it now. And thus you have the idea of spoil in our text. Spoil. Spoil is what pirates get, right? They take loot. They take spoil. It's stuff that is taken. Now, the picture you get here with those who are greedy is you have men who are takers. You have men who are takers. Fundamentally, they are predators. They show their strength by taking. They're not producing anything. They're just taking. Now, contrast this twisted masculinity, where men are takers and wealth is evidence of personal power, with true biblical masculinity, where men are producers and wealth is evidence of the blessing of God. If we look back in the early chapters of Genesis, we see that God created the first man, Adam, and all men after him, number one, to be a husband to his wife, and to be a husbandman, to the garden sanctuary, and to the world. And what that means is this. God created men to use their strength, to use masculine strength to serve God and others, okay? And that's a good definition of biblical masculinity. My strength in the service of God and others. That is true biblical masculinity. The man is supposed to use his strength to provide, to protect, and in this way to bring to glory and to bring to fruitfulness. The man is supposed to serve his wife. He is supposed to make her glorious. He's supposed to make her fruitful. It's the same thing with the garden sanctuary, which is a picture of the church. The man is supposed to use his strength to serve the church, to make the church glorious and fruitful. And it is the same with the earth, bringing the earth to full glory and fruitfulness. Contrast this with the young men in our text. True biblical masculinity produces. It doesn't take. It makes wealth. It creates wealth. It doesn't take it. False masculinity takes wealth. The young men in our text don't produce anything. They take. They don't serve anyone else. They serve themselves. Whereas true masculinity does not serve itself. It serves God and others. Also, there is profit in all labor because it adds value. So a truly biblically masculine man adds labor to those things which are legitimate and thus creates wealth. These guys labor only to take. And let me tell you this from my time in the criminal justice system. I have seen criminals that if they worked half as hard as they do to take stuff, if they worked half that hard in a real legitimate job, they'd go right to the top. But they're not going to work to do that. They don't want to work to work. They want to work to take. It's the only kind of work that appeals to them. The other thing here is we see patience with true masculinity. True masculinity is patience. It's not characterized by greed. It's not grabalicious. It's not making haste to be wealthy. Making something fruitful takes time. A farmer puts seed in the ground. The farmer waters the seed. The farmer takes care of the ground. The farmer gets rid of the weeds that grow up. The farmer gets the rocks out. The farmer takes all of this time and work, and sowing and reaping is a long-term thing. And the farmer is patient. looking forward to the fruitfulness. And that's what true masculinity does. And so true masculinity focuses on the long term rather than the short term. I have to have it right now. Now, our passage ends with Solomon warning his son that greed for gain and everything it leads to, such as gang life, it's all false masculinity. It's all lies. It will never fulfill either the young man or the young woman who likes him. It makes false promises. It makes false promises to young men, and it makes false promises to young ladies who like those young men. In reality, as Solomon says, greed for gain takes away the life of its owners one way or another. If you have a group of young men or a sole young man that is seeking to express greed for gain through violence, most of them come to a violent end. In high crime inner city neighborhoods, with a lot of the young men, life expectancy is about 25 years. You live by the sword, you die by the sword. It's a horrendous death rate. But even if you're doing it by stealth as opposed to by violence, it's going to turn to ashes in your hands. So let me point out some of the other verses that are in Proverbs that speak to this. I want to contrast here wealth that comes as from the blessing of God to wealth that is taken because young men are gravelicious. In Proverbs 22:4, it says, "By humility and the fear of the Lord are riches and honor and life." Now, humility, that sounds squishy to young men. That sounds feminine. That sounds sissy, humility. Humility in the Bible simply means a man who is in subjection to the man, to God. That's what humility is. It's just simple faithfulness and obedience. So simple faithfulness to God and obedience to God, the fear of the Lord, this is how riches and honors and life come. In other words, they are the gift of God. You cannot pursue them directly. If you pursue them directly, you've made them an idol and they're going to turn to ashes. You pursue God. You pursue faithfulness to Him. You pursue your strength in the service of God and others. Riches and honor and life are things that God gives to you on the rebound. In Proverbs 10:22, it says, "The blessing of the Lord makes one rich, and He adds no sorrow to it." The simple fact of wealth or poverty does not tell you whether someone is under the blessing of God or not. Sometimes wealth is the blessing of God. Sometimes wealth is the curse of God. Sometimes poverty is the blessing of God. Sometimes it is the curse of God. You only want the wealth that is the blessing of God because then God adds no trouble to it. If you obtain wealth the wrong way, you've got headaches and heartaches all the time. Proverbs 28:20, "A faithful man will abound with blessings, but he who hastens to be rich will not go unpunished." He who hastens. Now, you don't have to join a gang, young men. If you're in a hurry to be rich, if that's important to you instead of faithfulness to God, you will not go unpunished. God promises you that. Proverbs 13:11, "Wealth gained by dishonesty." Here we're not talking about violence, we're talking about dishonesty. "Wealth gained by dishonesty will diminish." It's going to go down. You will not be able to sustain it. "He who gathers by labor," this is true masculinity, "will increase." Proverbs 21:17, "He who loves pleasure will be a poor man. He who loves wine and oil will not be rich." Young men naturally want to measure true masculinity in terms of the bling that it can bring you. You know, I can drink a beer, I can smoke a cigar, I can drive a car, and I can put a loud megaphone on the exhaust pipe just so you know that I'm here. I can do all these things, you know, and I want good things in my house, and I want to spend all my money for all these things so you can see how big my biceps are and how strong I am, and girls will be attracted to me. You're going to be a poor man. You're going to be poor. That's what the Bible says. On the other hand, Proverbs 15:6, "In the house of the righteous, there is much treasure." The righteous has wine, the righteous has oil, the righteous has good food, but he's never really sought those. He just sought to be faithful and use his strength in the service of God and others. So let me then leave you, young man, with four things that you must learn if you want to be biblically masculine, true biblical masculine. And young ladies, by the way, this is the kind of guy you want to attract. No other guy is worth attracting. So you got to be the right woman so that you get the right guy and attract him. The first thing young men must be to be biblically masculine, number one, be God's man. Be God's man in terms of your loves, your passions, your understanding, your vision, your priorities. Be God's man. Number two, be ambitious like Jesus. Be ambitious like Jesus, okay? Ambition is neither right or wrong. It depends on what you're being ambitious for. And if you look at our typical picture Bibles and the way we describe Jesus, you would say, well, Jesus had no ambitions at all. He's the prototypical flower child. He's lithe and he's effeminate and he floats around in a robe and he has willowy features and long hair and blue eyes, even though he's a Jew. I don't know how that happens, but somehow he's basically a metro-looking dude from the first century. No, Jesus was the most ambitious man who ever lived. But he was ambitious in the right way. He was ambitious for his Father's glory, and he was ambitious for his Father's blessing. The outcome of Jesus' ministry, his life and his death and his resurrection, the goal, what he was promised by his Father, the goal he is seeking, was all authority in heaven and on earth, and all judgment being committed into his hands. I call that ambitious. I call that ambitious. But he was ambitious the right way. That's the way you want to be ambitious, young man. If you're ambitious the wrong way, you're always going to be looking sideways at who your competition is and trying to outdo your competition. Jesus was never looking sideways. He was always looking up. He was always looking at what his Father was calling him to do. When he looked sideways, he was looking at his brethren, at those whom he could serve. He didn't look sideways to compete, but to serve. Okay. So you want to be ambitious like Jesus. A couple of other good biblical role models are Joseph and Daniel. Both very ambitious, but the right way. And they rose to the top, but as the blessing of God. Number three, be patient like the farmer. Be patient like the farmer. You're engaged in a long-term business. Sowing and reaping is long-term. Making others fruitful is a long-term exercise. So be patient like the farmer. Invest yourself. And finally, number four, be under before you are over. Be under before you are over. In Luke chapter 16, verse 12, Jesus says, if you have not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? If you have not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? God's not. What that means is this. If you don't know what it is, if you cannot from the heart submit yourself to another's authority, if you cannot make it your goal to make somebody else successful, then you don't deserve to have that which is your own. And if you're going to get what is your own, you're going to do so by cutting corners, dishonesty, or taking, and you're not going to be blessed. God is not going to give you that which is your own if you don't know how to serve another and to submit from the heart from another. And by the way, let me tell you this, young man. This is what it means to be a faithful biblical employee. Your number one goal within the will of God, okay, we're not talking about doing things that are illegal or unrighteous. Within the will of God, your goal is to make your boss successful. Your goal is not to make yourself successful. Your goal legitimately is to make your boss successful. And let me tell you something. As soon as your boss figures out that that's your heart, there are two thoughts that are coming to come in to their mind. Number one, that is rare. You're going to astound them because they probably never will have met anybody like you. Number two, you're going up. Responsibility and authority are going to chase you down from behind as soon as your boss figures that out. I commend all of these things to you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.